often the steps you take professionally don't come out of success, they come out of failure. And if I'd done at all well as an actor, I mean, even if I'd had a very small break as an actor, I'd have kept on acting. If I'd have had a more consistent career as a screenwriter, I'd have kept on screenwriting. In both professions, I came to a dead end, and that's when I took up the next thing, which isn't to say it was a kind of concession. I mean, I just didn't have the confidence to write a novel until I was forced to.
I'm Hattie Crissell, I'm a journalist, and this is In Writing, in which I invite myself into the studies of great writers of all kinds and talk to them about how they work. David Nichols is my interviewee today. He's the author of five very affecting and funny novels, including 2009's incredibly successful One Day and his most recent bestseller, Sweet Sorrow. He's also a wonderful screenwriter. His adaptations include 2015's Far From the Madding Crowd with Carey Mulligan, plus screen versions of three of his novels. He won a BAFTA this year for Best Writer of a TV Drama for his adaptation of Patrick Melrose, starring Benedict Cumberbatch. I went to visit David on an autumn day at a very tidy flat in the heart of London. It's not where he lives, but it's where he works, as you'll hear him explain. It's the second time I've interviewed him. He's a very down-to-earth guy and always lovely to talk to. His office was very peaceful, apart from the sounds of children playing in a nearby playground, and we sat on his sofa and talked about his parallel careers and how two very distinct kinds of writing work for him. So, over to David.
So we are in my office. I realised that I was finding it harder and harder to write at home and in libraries, that I was getting a bit distracted. So I'm very lucky to have another space that I can go to every day and treat like an office. So I get here at 8:30 or 9 and make coffee and start the day. And this is where I stay until the day's work is finished. And that means that when I go home, I'm not working. I'm home. So okay. That's a distinction that it helps me to make.
Yeah. And would you ever come here at the weekends, or are you very Monday to Friday?
No, I'm pretty Monday to Friday. If there's a crisis, I will come at the weekends. But no, I'm pretty strict. And also, I'm kind of useless in the evenings anyway. I mean, I've never... There's a romantic idea of writers, you know, staying up through the night and working by candlelight with a glass of whiskey by their side, and I'm no good at that. I just fall asleep or feel guilty about it. And I've also, and this is a bit precious, but I find it hard to write well if there are other people moving around in the house. Even a library is better than that, because in the library there's an atmosphere of labour, and at home, it's just I found myself getting a little twitchy and irritated. So for a long time I worked at the British Library and the London Library, and now I go to the office.
Yeah. And would you describe this space a little bit, and what, you know, your work area?
So there's a desk, which is where I ought to sit, with a desktop computer, and that's where I ought to sit. And I ought to sit sitting up straight, concentrating in a sort of ergonomic chair. But more often than not, after a couple of hours, I find myself lying on the sofa where we're sitting now and writing, laying down. There are some things where you really need a desktop. If I'm working on a script, and a lot of that work involves moving things around, having previous drafts easily accessible, copying and pasting, it's more structural, it's more editorial, then I really need to sit up straight and write on a desktop. If I'm writing fiction, and it's... I suppose what you're hoping for with fiction is a kind of flow, a kind of lack of self, a loss of self-awareness. And without being pretentious, you know, you want to be in a certain state of mind. And I find often that I'm better off doing that sitting in a comfortable chair or lying down. So I write between there, which is where I should be, and here, where I usually end up falling asleep.
Don't you have back problems writing on a sofa?
Yeah, I'm starting to get them now.
Oh no.
They've just kicked in. But I have one of these terrible, I have to hide it when people come around. Oh no, I've just glimpsed it. This terrible tray, which has got a soft, like a cushion underneath. And I think it's sort of designed for people to eat their tea in front of the television.
Yeah,
you know, a kind of sort of lap tray. this awful, terrible, squalid piece of equipment which I put on my lap and feel embarrassed by. But it means that I can write pretty efficiently with a laptop. The back problems are still to come, I'm sure.
What are some of your favourite things in this room?
I'm constantly alternating about music. You know, I sometimes I find the silence at the beginning of the day a bit daunting. So sometimes I will listen to quiet music in the hope that when the music stops, I won't notice. But a silent room is a bit like a blank page. It can be a bit intimidating. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of CDs here and kind of...
Quite retro to have so many CDs,
isn't it?
Now.
This office acts as a bit of a dump for things that we don't want in the house anymore. So so all the CDs and nasty cushions and useless stuff we get bored of gets dumped here. But so all the CDs are here and there are a few books. Most of my books are at home, but sometimes I like to have a few appropriate books around if I'm writing a novel, books that are kind of touchstones, things to aspire to, things I want to write. So I will have just a few carefully chosen books by my side. But most of the books are at home. And there are just some pictures on the wall, again, which... don't really serve a purpose. I think you're just trying to make a space that's comfortable and personal. When I finished writing one day, I thought the answer was to have a very harsh, cold, uncomfortable space in which to write. I hired this office that was just a desk and a chair. I mean, literally like it was grim. It was like a prison cell. It was deliberately chosen for its lack of distraction, its lack of comfort, no soft chair, just a desk to sit and write. And that didn't really work out. And now I've realized that actually, you know, family photos, postcards, music and books are good things to have around you.
Yeah.
As a kind of subliminal inspiration, I suppose.
What are your first memories of writing?
After university, not really knowing what I was going to do professionally, I went to New York. I'd never really left the country, and so I wanted to study abroad and ended up in New York in this tiny room studying acting at a drama school there. And it was very lonely. It was really tough. I mean, it was actually sort of what I was looking for, really. I had this masochistic notion of being alone in a big city, and that's what I got. And I had a lot of time on my hands as well, and I started writing letters, and I went to 42nd Street, one of those cheap electronic stores, and bought this thing called a Canon Star Writer. And it was a very, very, very early kind of word processor. You could store maybe a page on it, and you could review what you'd written on a tiny little LED screen. And I wrote a lot of letters. I didn't write short stories. I didn't write poems. I didn't write plays. I certainly didn't think of writing a novel. I just wrote letters to friends. And because suddenly I had this ability to, you know, to play with the text, to rewrite. I think it showed two lines of text, but you could edit and refine. And these letters were quite elaborate. And I used to really like sitting there in this tiny, tiny little room, kind of writing a sort of memoir, really, through letters, telling funny stories and sort of keeping in touch, but trying to be funny. And that was the first writing. That was the first pleasure I got from writing. I wouldn't have dreamed of expressing it as an ambition. I think it was always there, but I didn't really see how it could come about. But I used to love the idea that people would open these things, read these marks on the page and laugh. That seemed to me to have a kind of magic to it. And so I spent a surprisingly long amount of time on these letters. And that was the first writing I ever did, I think. Mm. I mean, at school, you know, I did what I had to do and I enjoyed doing it. And I wrote a lot of you know, terrible pompous essays and poems and things, but I for because I had to for O levels. But no, the first pleasure I got out of it was, and this is about 91, 92, I think.
Okay, but then you pursued acting for a while.
Yeah, I did. And writing, I used to go on tour. If I was in rep in a play or I was on tour, I would again send these little kind of humorous accounts of how unhappy I was. but then two friends that I used to write to, my friend Matthew Orchis, who was a theatre director, and another friend called Claudia Lloyd, who was a TV producer, they both separately said, you know, you can be funny in the written word, why not try writing something? And acting wasn't going very well. And I was working as a script reader, so I was reading a huge amount of, a huge number of plays and film scripts and television scripts. And my friend Matthew wanted to adapt this Sam Shepard play called Simpatico. He thought it would make a good film. And I was much more of a film fan than he was. I'd seen a lot more films, I read a lot more film scripts. And so that was the first writing, with an aim in mind. And we worked on this film script on and off for years. It was incredibly unprofessional and incompetent. We didn't set it up properly on the page. You know, it was written on a word processor rather than final draft software. I didn't know what a screenplay ought to look like. I didn't really know how long scenes ought to be or how to present them. But we discovered that as we went along. And about the same time as this, my friend Claudia, who was a comedy producer, said, there's something in this experience of being an out-of-work actor. And I was working in a lot of bars and restaurants. And why not write down the stories that you tell, you know, at parties? Mm. Try and turn them into a sitcom. And I'd grown up really loving sitcoms and watching a lot of TV comedy. And so at the same time, I was writing this very different 25-minute BBC One sitcom script. And things happened with both of those scripts. The film, because Matthew Waters is a theatre director, he was doing very well, he was able to contact Sam Shepard about this play, and we got to speak to him and got his permission, and the film was eventually produced. And with Claudia, I got a very, very small amount of money from the BBC via Geoffrey Perkins, a really brilliant comedy executive who was very generous and took a chance on me. And so I had my first money for writing. Mm. And it was certainly not enough to live on, but it was a terrific boost to my confidence. And after that, I began to be a little bit more focused and to write for a purpose other than the personal business of getting laughs from friends.
Yeah, and the thing that people often talk about now that was one of your first kind of big successes was you worked on Cold Feet.
Yeah, and I got that sort of roundabout way through the sitcom, because I had scripts to show people, and I managed to get an agent, and I met Christine Langan, the producer of Cold Feet, and I got to write a sample script and joined the team. It was the third series, so you know, the difficult work had all been done by Mike Bullen. You know, he created the characters, created a style, fixed a style, and it was about writing to that format. And that was a really brilliant training. Very frightening, unnerving, a huge leap from what I'd been doing. But I learnt a huge amount in about plotting, about structure, about the rewriting process, about writing for actors. It was a baptism of fire. But those 4 hours of television, I think, was sort of my apprenticeship, really. Yeah. And it was at a time where the show had really hit its stride and it had a mixture of comedy and drama that I was initially a bit intimidated by, but actually found it very enjoyable to write. And I think, I've drawn from myself, I think. I think Cold Fleet was very influential for my own writing. So that was a big break.
And you published Starter for 10, your first novel, 2003,
I think. Yeah.
So at what point did you start working on that? And did it feel like a bit of a jump to start on novel, or did it just feel like the natural next step?
It sort of came out of necessity, really. I was really enjoying writing scripts, and the episodes I'd written for Cold Feet had done well, and I was given my own, I was developing a couple of other things with different TV companies, and they got greenlit, which is kind of the writer's dream, really. One was a show called Rescue Me, which was about magazine journalists. And this was about the time of Sex and the City and all of that. And I'd written this very melancholy, sad show about divorce and misery and loneliness in London. And it didn't do very well. It was, you know, we really put heart and soul into it, and it just didn't get the audiences. It was, I don't know, too metropolitan, or, well, not well written enough, really, probably. And so that didn't get a second series. And so suddenly, and it wasn't that it hadn't got a second series, it was that it had done quite badly. So I was suddenly, I didn't have any work. I didn't have anything to write. I wasn't being asked to do anything. The time I put aside to write the second series was suddenly empty. And I'd always wanted to write about university. And yet there was a kind of unspoken rule. No, it was a spoken rule in British television, which was no students, no actors. And
why is that?
Because the consensus was that with students, was that unlike in America, there's a kind of college tradition. In Britain, there's a kind of, rightly or wrongly, there's an antipathy to students and the dilemma of the student lifestyle that the general audience doesn't warm to.
Right.
They don't care if the essay doesn't get in time. They don't care, you know, they don't care if their characters are drunk all the time. That there's no, the stakes are too low, and people tend not to like students. That was the idea. That was what we kept getting told, because as a script editor, I was always trying to pitch student shows, university shows, and they never went anywhere. And so I was just jotting down ideas, and the ideas were prose, you know, they were first person prose. And I thought, well, maybe it's a monologue or something. But I wrote quite a long section, and thought that maybe it had potential as a comic novel. And that was the central section of Start of a Ten. It was about 10,000 words in the middle. I gave it to a friend of mine, said, you know, what do you think of this? Is there something here? Could it maybe be a film or something? But she passed it to an agent, and the agent read it and liked it, and that became Start of a Ten. Mm. So it was, if my TV career had, often the steps you take professionally don't come out of success, they come out of failure. And if I'd done at all well as an actor, I mean, even if I'd had a very small break as an actor, I'd have kept on acting. If I'd have had a more consistent career as a screenwriter, I'd have kept on screenwriting. But in both professions, I came to a dead end, and that's when I took up the next thing. Which isn't to say it was a kind of concession. I mean, I just didn't have the confidence to write a novel until I was forced to. So I was very lucky to have that obligation. And then actually, once I did start writing it, I loved it. The first time, as is so often the case with first novels, I think, is you have a lifetime of stories and anecdotes and ideas and jokes, particularly jokes if it's a comic novel, and they all just pour out. And I wrote it very, very quickly. Because I'd been working in television, I wrote a very, very detailed synopsis, character breakdowns, all of the things that I'd have been required to write for an episode of Cold Feet, I wrote down for the novel before I started writing it, and gave that to my editor. And they'd never really seen a document like this, because it wasn't really appropriate to writing fiction. It was a strange thing to do, but it meant that I could write it very quickly and with a great deal of pleasure. The second book, as is so often the case, was much, much, much harder.
The second book was The Understudy.
Yeah. And contractually, I was obliged, I think at that stage, to write a novel a year. And that clearly wasn't going to happen.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. No, and I don't know how serious that, I mean, I don't know if anyone ever expected that to happen, but it was much harder and required a bit more digging. And I was also writing in the third person, and this sounds technical and silly, but in my mind, I was, when you write in the first person, often it's about getting into character. And if you can do the voice and you know what the story is, you can sort of let it flow. And in third person, you're suddenly this other voice, the novelist, and you have to have a take on the world and an attitude and a sense of humour and a tone and an attitude to your characters and their dilemma. And I found that much, much harder. So I found the second, you know, the difficult second novel, it's true, I did find that one very hard. And at the end, by the time I'd finished writing it, I knew that it was a much better novel, but it didn't do so well. So I went back to television for a little while. I was sort of out of TV jail, and I went back and did a version of Tess of the D'Urbervilles, which was a book I'd always loved. And I came across this passage about how each year we live through a particular day which has a terrible significance in the future that we don't yet know. And I remembered reading the novel at 16 and thinking that was an amazing idea in a very teenage, angsty kind of way. And when I sat down with my editor to talk about the third novel, I pitched this idea. What if it's about one day a year, but you don't know what the significance of the day is until the end of the novel? And because the second novel hadn't done so well, no one was tapping their watch for the third novel. So I spent a long time planning it. I went back to, because it was a sort of a puzzle, what are they doing on the 15th of July each year? I had to know what they were doing on the other days as well. And so I had to work out 20 years worth of biography for these two characters. That took a little while. And I took a lot longer to write that book. I took about 3 years to write that. And in between, worked on a couple of script projects. But when I wrote the whole book, and then I rewrote the whole book, which I'd never done before, I wrote it out again from scratch. It took a long time, but it definitely helped the prose. I mean, I had the first draft printed out, and I typed it again. And every now and then I'd think, oh, I'm a bit bored now. Let's skip this. Or it was a way of editing very, very, very thoroughly, word by word, rather than skimming the page and thinking, oh, this is okay. So it took about 3 years to write One Day. And the fourth book was very hard to write because One Day had taken off and I just got really stuck. And so I was stuck in this miserable cell-like office, almost literally banging my head against the wall, trying to come up with something. And I thought, well, maybe you need to try a different approach. And I tried making it up as I went along. So completely different attitude, just improvising the book. Around certain themes and ideas. And it took forever to come up with the smallest number of words, about 25, 30,000 words, about the first quarter of the book. And I gave that to Johnny, my agent, and we both decided that it was no good. So I scrapped that. It felt portentous that I threw it away. It felt like the end of something. And consequently was a bit of a worry. But was absolutely the right decision, because then I started again from scratch and did some thinking and did some planning and did what I used to do, writing out the biographies and the storyline. And that was us, and that came quite quickly and was really enjoyable and involved a certain amount of research, you know, because it's set on this grand tour of Europe. So was fun to write and a different experience to One Day. Quite emotional, because my father was ill and dying during the time I was writing it, and actually died when I was about halfway through the novel, and the novel was about family and about fathers and sons. So it was quite emotional, but again, once I had the character's voice, it came quite quickly. There's a conclusion at the end of this. The most recent book, I knew I wanted to write a coming-of-age book. I knew I wanted to write something set over the course of one summer. I knew I wanted to write a memory book. I knew I wanted to write about putting on a play, youth theatre, that experience when you're a kid. And I knew I wanted to write it from the point of view of someone who thinks it's ridiculous. but I didn't know if it was third person or first person. I didn't know where and when it was set. I didn't know any of those things. At one point, fleetingly, it was going to be a kind of One Day spin-off, because Emma Morley was going to be in the theatre company. And then I thought that was a gimmick and I abandoned that idea. But I had a kind of Word document, which I think was called Summer. And by this stage, I was writing the scripts of Patrick Melrose. But it was a kind of notebook, a scrapbook full of ideas and memories and character sketches and exchanges of dialogue. And rather than planning out the novel, I just threw in little tidbits over the course of about 18 months. and then took some time off to work on Melrose again, and then went back to it, picked out the bits I liked, worked out what the story was, and then wrote Sweet Sorrow again quite fluidly, with a break in the middle when we actually started shooting Melrose. And that was, again, a completely different process. So the terrible truth is, and that's a long way of saying this, that there's no real recipe, there's no approach, there's no process that I can go through that I know will result in a novel. And every time it's different. And writing the fourth novel doesn't make writing the fifth one any easier whatsoever. You might learn things line by line about technique and editing and first person, third person, present tense, past tense. You learn that stuff as you go along, but you don't get better at being inspired.
Right.
And that is the hardest part.
Right. Do you know what you're going to do for your sixth novel?
No.
No reason why you should. No, Harry.
No, well, there is a reason. I mean, I think I do worry about it. I wouldn't be nice to have a glimmer of something. And at the moment, I don't. I mean, I have a kind of feeling. I know what I sort of want it to be. But that changes day by day. And I don't have plot or characters. And I think each of the books I've written have come out of often quite... They haven't been autobiographical, but I recognise when I look back that they've come out of quite major life events or at stages of my life. And if you don't have those huge preoccupations, or if those preoccupations are a bit self-centred and boring, then it won't give you a novel. I mean, what I mean, I suppose, is that I don't want to write a novel about being a middle-aged writer.
Right.
I don't want to write my circumstances and preoccupations now, because they're not very interesting to anyone, I don't think. And I know that if I drew from life at the moment, it wouldn't be a very good book. I want to write outside myself more. Mm-hmm. And I also don't want to write nostalgically anymore. I don't want to write about the 80s or the 90s or the 2000s. I want to write something set now. And so I feel a bit anxious at this moment.
But I mean, the other side of anxious, I suppose, is excited. And you've got this kind of blank possibility at the moment of something. And all of those five books, although they've come together in different ways, they have all ultimately come together and become very good novels. So you know, at least that is something that you learned from experience, that you'll get there.
I suppose so. I mean, I hope so. I think, though, there are also, you know, I'm really fond of all five of them, very proud of them. But I know that some are better than others. And I know that the writing is, you know, variable, not always consistent. And perhaps the next one is going to be a disaster. And I mean, I think you'd start with that thought is always next to the other thought. How exciting, I can write anything I want. Because with fiction, you can. You don't have to think about budget or running time or who it's for. You know, you just write the book you want to write. And there's nothing stopping me from sitting down this afternoon and putting pen to paper or typing out notes. No one's going to see it. No one's going to, you know, publish it against my will. I can do anything I want. And that in itself can be quite intimidating.
Yeah.
The freedom of it is both exciting and also stalling. That's why, you know, if someone says to me, here's a great book, we think it might make a fantastic film, it's very tempting for me, because I really enjoy that process. It's a very, very different process. And I do sometimes feel, not with original screenwriting, but with adaptation, that it's a bit like copying someone else's homework. That they've done the stuff that I find frightening. They've created the characters and the stories and the situation.
You've now adapted three of your novels into screen versions.
Yeah.
Start of 10, yeah. One Day, and now Us, which will be coming soon to a screen near us.
Yeah.
What is that like, adapting your own novel for screen? And has your approach to it changed between Start of 10 and Us?
I think I've learned certain things. I, I, I've I mean, it's much harder than you think it's going to be. If I write a page of dialogue in a novel, I like writing dialogue, and often it's not something that I edit very much. Often the first draft will be what's in the finished book, because it's a bit like ad-libbing as an actor. Sometimes you can come up with quite good stuff the first time, and I don't tend to rewrite it. And then you think, well, I'm going to adapt this for the screen. I'll just copy it out. It's the moment you copy it out, you have to start changing it. For a start, a script has got to be 58, if it's for television, it has to be 57, 58 pages long. So
that's if for you, an hour.
Yeah. If you ramble on, or if you repeat anything, you're going to be using up this precious, and you never have enough space. You never, ever get to page 48 and think, that's it, the story's told. You always get to page 72. So suddenly you're going to have to start trimming. You're going to have to start condensing. And when you start doing that, you start to lose. Often you have to retain information and lose color. You have to cut out jokes or repetition or rhythm. So you're going to have to rewrite it with that in mind. At a later stage, you're going to have to rewrite it with actors in mind. And that can be a good thing, to have an actor's voice and face in your head and amend it for that end.
That's interesting. So a script might change depending on who's playing the part.
I like to know who's playing the part, and then I will write to them. Yeah, not radically, but to a degree. I mean, when I did an adaptation of Far From the Madding Crowd, and when Carrie was on board, both because I knew it was Carrie and both because Carrie had some input on the script was amended with Carrie in my head.
Yeah.
Same with Patrick Melrose and Benedict. I mean, it's a slightly intangible thing because you don't know how conscious it is, but I like to know who the actor is.
Yeah.
So you will, of course, amend it for that purpose. When you write a novel, you can put the information in the spaces between the dialogue. When you write a script, you have to put the information into the dialogue. So you're going to have to amend the dialogue for that reason as well. And then you're also going to, in a novel, there's the reader can have a certain amount of forgiveness for stuff that isn't entirely necessary, stuff that that's there because it's funny or because it's colour or it's revealing of character. In the script, you have to be far, far, far more economical. So it may well be that when the director comes on board, they say, we don't need this scene. So you may lose the whole thing anyway. It may become superfluous because it's only there for a joke or because it's an observation that doesn't have the same role in the screenplay. So you will have to rewrite it endlessly, and the rewriting will continue even after you've shot it, because you'll go into the edit and you'll watch the scene and you'll think, actually, this is dragging a little bit. Let's cut the beginning, let's cut the end, let's cut the speech in the middle. So it will go through endless permutations. And yet when you wrote the novel, it was the work of 3 minutes. So it's very stressful. And a lot of these changes are imposed on you by budget and time. A lot of these changes are suggested by performers or directors. A lot of these changes might happen when you're not even in the room. They might happen in the edit. So it's a very different process, very stressful.
Do you ever resent that if an actor or somebody suggests a change, or and it's something that you don't... I mean, do you have to make changes that you sometimes really would rather not?
Very rarely now. I mean, I feel like I really love actors and value actors' input. And I don't. At the same time, I don't spend a lot of time with actors when we're shooting, because I think often you'll have a conversation and an actor might say, oh, wouldn't it be funny if I did this? And I find it very hard to say, no, stick to the script.
Yeah. You know,
there's suddenly a power relationship there that I'm not particularly comfortable with. So I do avoid the actors when we're shooting. And I don't know if that's the right thing to do. It might be better just to be around but be more confident. I'm not very good at that. I think... after read-throughs, after rehearsals, and via a director, I'm very, very happy for changes to be suggested. And usually I will take them on board and do something, because I want actors to be happy and comfortable, and also want to draw on their experience. But I do hate it if I watch rushes and a line's been changed without me knowing. I mean, that is not on, and it doesn't happen very often. Melrose, for instance, I think is almost word perfect. And there's no ad-libbing, there's no changing the dialogue. It's exactly as it was written in the script. And I'm very grateful for that. But sometimes it happens. Sometimes, I don't want to be the kind of writer shaking the fist at, you know, these pesky actors, because often an actor's suggestion will improve something.
Yeah.
So more often it works in your favour. Yeah. But inevitably, a script isn't a finished work. You know, a script is an instruction manual that you give to 100 people and try and build this thing together. And it won't look like the version you have in your head.
Mm. With Patrick Melrose, you boiled down 5 novels to 5 episodes.
Yeah.
Where do you even, just on a, you know, structurally, where do you even begin to approach something like that? Do you have to plot out the things that you know you want to include and then work around that? Or
you have to, the important thing, and I've learned this from experience, the important thing is not to précis the story. You know, if you squeeze everything in but don't give it the time it needs, then people who love the novel, yes, they'll be able to sit there and tick off the bits they like, but it won't work. It will feel like a little synopsis rather than a drama in itself. So if you're going to make cuts, I always compare it to surgery. You know, you've got to be bold and you've got to say, when better to play this scene at some length and make it land than include everything from the novel and just skitter over things. So it wasn't actually as big a problem with Patrick Melrose as you think, because 3 of the 5 novels take place in quite a condensed period of time. You know, they have a kind of, I was going to say Aristotelian, and I stopped myself because I don't really know what it means. I think I know what it means, but I don't think it is what it means. But they all happen in a single time and place in a particular set over quite a short period of time. Mm. And that's easier to adapt than something that leaps across generations. Books 4 and 5, I mean, the fourth book, Mother's Milk, takes place over 4 years and with children growing up, which is always a nightmare in an adaptation. So there are much, much, much bolder cuts in that. But the first 3, Some Hope, Never Mind, and Bad News, are pretty faithful. And again, if you take out things, it's usually repetition. In the novel of Bad News, there's a scene where Patrick Melrose goes to a nightclub and tries to pick up this girl and treats her very badly. And it's very powerful and uncomfortable and unpleasant in the book. And a very fine piece of writing. And on screen, it could have been great. You know, you could have had this 1980s New York nightclub. Could have looked brilliant. But it was repeating a feeling that we'd had in the previous scene where he'd gone out for dinner with this woman and behaved badly. And
so we already had that information. We've had that, Patrick.
Yeah. And again, you're more forgiving of repetition in a novel than you are on screen. And so there are drafts of the script where that exists, and it just was quite an easy cut.
When you look back over your writing in your career so far, have there been sort of lessons that you've learned that have helped you become a better writer? Have there been breakthrough moments that changed the way you worked?
I've learned a huge amount about writing from working on other people's books. And I did a film, not many people saw it, but I was really proud of it, a version of Blake Morrison's And When Did You Last See Your Father, which was a book I really loved and meant a great deal to me. And I think often another writer will give you a sort of hand up so that you feel able to write about things that perhaps seem a little out of reach. So I think that was a big help for me in terms of writing One Day and writing stuff that was a little darker, more serious. Similarly, you know, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, in a weird kind of way. There are very few laughs in Tess of the D'Urbervilles, so I think it enabled me to feel more confident about writing dramatically. In terms of screenwriting, I think a lot of the difficulty with screenwriting is working out what fights to choose, when to put your foot down and say, absolutely not. We've got to keep that scene. it's got to be like this. And I'm not very good at that. It's not, it doesn't come naturally, that kind of confidence. I feel I have it more now than I did when I started. But when I started, I was so sort of grateful and excited that I kind of let things go. And I feel that you do have to sometimes, you know, fight your corner quite vigorously, even if you lose friends, you know, even if you it affects your you, people perhaps don't think so kindly of you. I think I'm still picking my way through that, learning when to push back.
Yeah,
because it is very, very, very combative and collaborative, and I love the collaboration, and I don't like this fundamental thing that you have to say, which is no.
Yeah.
Do it like this.
Yeah.
I think I will always find that difficult. I become slightly better at knowing when, what to fight for, I think.
Yeah.
I look back at, you know, the stuff I did on screen earlier in my career. I remember really, you know, kicking up a fuss over certain things that actually weren't important at all, and letting things slide when they were absolutely fundamental. And I've become a bit better at knowing which battles to choose. I'm not being very eloquent, but I feel like I know when to really absolutely say no.
Yeah.
Even if I immediately cave.
And what are you proudest of in your career?
Well, I think it should be, and is, in fact, your most recent work. And I'm really proud of Sweet Sorrow. I feel like it sort of does what I wanted it to do, and it's the most consistently written. The one that I feel closest to, and not because it's particularly autobiographical, but because, you know, it touches on things that I feel strongly. I mean, this is a hard question, because pride is a good thing, but vanity is not. I feel like I'm quite good to work with. I feel proud that I'm polite and calm and civil, and if I am fraught and anxious about something, I still am able to be pleasant and try to be, you know, collaborative and a good person to work alongside. So I've never had any particular admiration for people who are, you know, rude or storm out of meetings or throw things. I wouldn't be able to pull it off even if I wanted to, but I think it's important to maintain a certain amount of politeness and civility and professionalism. And I think I do that. It goes back to, you know, I never liked missing deadlines at school. You know, I like to hand my homework in. And professionally, I like to hand my homework in and for it to be as good as it can be. Yeah. Which doesn't mean you don't make mistakes. But if I can make something better and I have the time to do it, I will do it. At the same time, you know, you get things wrong. You miss the point. It's never going to be perfect. But if I can make it better, I'll do my best to do so.
Well, thank you so much for speaking.
That was all right.
It was wonderful.
Yeah. I feel like I've been very boring. Me, me, me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my chat with David Nichols. I can highly recommend his most recent book, Sweet Sorrow. And I also came very late to Patrick Melrose. I bought it recently from iTunes and watched it before I interviewed him. And if you missed it the first time round, I really would track it down if you can. It's incredibly moving. Thank you so much for listening to this. And if you enjoyed it, I would be thrilled if you'd click subscribe and leave a rating and a review. Apparently that bumps a podcast up the rankings at iTunes and helps it find more listeners. I have lots more great interviewees coming up, so see you next time. We'll